You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 11th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Lawrence in Arabia, war, deceit, imperial folly, and the making of the modern Middle East, with author Scott Anderson. Also on the program today, President Obama addresses the nation on the potential for an attack on Syria. New documents show the NSA surveillance program was nearly shut down by a FISA court judge in 2009. Bill de Blasio, one step closer to becoming the next mayor of New York City. Barrett Brown finally gets some press in the corporate media. Debt ceiling fight on the horizon. And surprise, surprise, the 1% has done rather well compared to the rest of us in the wake of the financial meltdown. It is September 11th, obviously the 12-year anniversary, I guess, of the attacks on this country. In some respects, maybe we are now out of the shadow of that day, as evidenced by the hesitation of the American people to sign on to an attack on Syria. Important to remember the people who died on that day and the first responders. Remember also how the Bush administration lied about the air quality in lower Manhattan, which caused another wave of problems for first responders. And also important to remember how that day was exploited and led to the deaths of tens of thousands, if not over 100,000 innocent civilians in Iraq. It is also the 40-year anniversary of the coup that overthrew Chilean President Salvador Allende and installed Pinochet with the help of this country, the Nixon administration. Important to remember, nearly just as many people died in that coup as died here in this country on 9/11. I'm not going to say much more about it. I mean, there's still, I think, some outlets that are engaging in the sort of the porn of the tragedy of that day. But I think it's a different era in New York City, at least, and I think in around the country. And to the extent that that day was used to justify things that we're still living with, including the overreach of the national security state. Hopefully that tide is turning a little bit. We will also get to the New York election results, or at least we'll touch on them. De Blasio got 40%. There'll be a recount, though, because that 40% threshold is the threshold needed to pass for a for no runoff with the second place finisher Thompson, who got 26%. Christine Quinn, 15%. Lou, 7%. Wiener, I think around, 5%, 4%. Randy Credico, 2%. And results that were pretty disappointing from my perspective. Elliot Spitzer, only 48%. Scott Stringer, 52% in the race for comptroller. I think Elliot Spitzer would have done some very interesting things in that position. But not to be. One note also, 40% is the cutoff where there will be no runoff. But that does not mean that in the event that he gets less than 40%, there will necessarily be a runoff. Thompson's numbers never top 35% in any, part of the city, which is an indication that he may not choose to engage in a runoff, in which case de Blasio would face Joe Lahota, who is has some renown for his disdain for kittens, if it means the trains aren't running on time in New York City. I don't know that there's much value in getting too much into that, as much of this audience does not live in New York City. But I think the chances of a Republican winning in this day and age in New York City, with the amount of class consciousness that seems to be present in New York, is pretty low. So we shall see. I don't know that de Blasio is the answer to all our problems in New York. I think in some respects that remains to be seen, but certainly with the field that we were looking at, he provides the best hope. And at the very least, it's an indication that in this city, there is a real problem in terms of the disparity of wealth and specifically between the 1% and the rest. I think, there has never been as much anxiety, even amongst those in the 95 percentile in terms of money, as rent is eating up an ever increasing portion of people's pay in this city. So at the very least, the de Blasio victory is an indication of the sentiment of New Yorkers, and it was a fairly sizable chunk of the Democratic electorate that came out. I think it was around 600,000 people, which figures quite well against past Democratic primaries. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Scott Anderson about his book, Lawrence in Arabia, to get a sense of the roots of the modern day conflicts in the Middle East. We'll be back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Scott Anderson, longtime war correspondent and author of the new Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Thanks, Sam. Pleasure to be here.
So your book has gotten really tremendous reviews in just about every major publication. So congratulations on that. And it is the result of as far as I can tell, 4 years of extensive research.
It's about 4.5 years I've been working on this project. And yeah, and everyone seemed to like it except the Wall Street Journal, which dogged me. So,
well, I got to be honest with you. It's pretty rare that I dig into that. So, all right. Well, with that said, now, you know, there obviously T.E. Lawrence is a fairly well-known figure, or at least has been, obviously portrayed famously in the movie Lawrence of Arabia. Why write this book?
Well, I've always been fascinated by Lawrence. I saw the movie, you know, as a kid, and was always fascinated by him as a figure. And over the years of having spent a lot of time reporting from the Middle East, if you get into any sort of deep conversation with anyone in the Middle East, invariably what comes up is that, you know, all the troubles started in World War One, and especially with the carving up of the region at the end of World War One at the Paris Peace Conference. And the more I became interested in trying to find out the kind of historical background of why the Middle East looks the way it does today, I realized that Lawrence was this great vehicle for personalizing that and explaining it, because he was at the center of so much that happened in that region.
And you also sort of tell this story of how the modern Middle East was developed through three other characters as well. William Yale, an American, Aaron Aronson, a Zionist, and a German spy, Kurt Prüfer. Am I pronouncing that?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, because what I wanted to do was to personalize and to show, the different historical forces that were at work in the Middle East at the time. And the amazing thing about the Middle East, and this is why I think using these four is a great vehicle for doing that, is that, you know, this was in the midst of World War One, and certainly for the European powers, virtually all their attention was focused on what was happening in the British and French case on the Western Front. So, but at the same time, there was another whole war theater in the Middle East. And so because it was such a secondary war front, it gave men like Lawrence and Prüfer and Yale and Aronson tremendous freedom to sort of improvise and to act as freelancers with very little adult supervision. So what you ended up seeing was these rather ordinary men, all the four men who are the principal characters, they were all in their late 20s, early 30s, but they ended up having a profound and outsized influence on the Middle East of today.
I want to talk about how each one, what they represent in terms of those forces that converged here. But let's just start with what we know as the modern Middle East. What was it prior to World War One?
It was all controlled by the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire had been in a state of decline for the previous century, famously known as the sick man of Europe. And the different European powers had taken turns nibbling away at the Ottoman Empire. The British had grabbed Egypt, the French had grabbed Morocco and Tunisia. They had lost most of their holdings in Eastern Europe. But from modern-day Turkey all the way down through the Middle East, including Iraq and the whole Saudi Arabian Peninsula, was still controlled by the Ottomans.
Let's go through these characters, and you know, to the extent that you can, obviously. But do you just give us a sense of what forces they represented, starting with William Yale, the American?
Yeah, William Yale, he was this fallen aristocrat. He was actually this kind of a scion of the American Gilded Age, and his family had lost their entire fortune virtually overnight in a financial panic. He shipped out to the Middle East just before the war as a local agent for the Standard Oil Company of New York. So when the war came along, he was in Syria, but in present day Palestine or Israel, basically lining up oil concessions for Standard Oil. When the Americans came into the war in 1917, he then became the only American field intelligence officer in the entire Middle East, while still on the payroll of Standard Oil.
Yes. Convenient that. Now, no, but let me ask you this. Was there a sense at that time, I mean, were there a lot of representatives from oil companies? I mean, was there a sense at that time that the Middle East was going to become was so important in terms of oil reserves that it did become? I mean, because, you know, I think people forget that in as late as 1950s, the United States was the biggest producer of oil in the country, I mean, the world.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So was there a sense that this is going to be a valuable asset in the future, or was this guy just sent out because we got to do a certain amount of due diligence and we've got this guy sitting around here, let's send him out there?
It's a bit of both, because basically what was happening by the beginning of World War One is that armies were starting to become mechanized, and so the demand for oil was growing exponentially, but still, you know, an infinitesimal fraction of what it would become. But interestingly, they really guessed wrong of where they thought oil was going to be. By the beginning of the 20th century, they had found oil in around the Caspian Sea and in Baku. And they had found it around Basra at the head of the Persian Gulf. No one had any idea that it was going to be found in the Arabian Peninsula. In fact, the reason William Yale was in Palestine was because by all geological surveys, everyone thought if there was any major oil to be found in the region, it was going to be along the Dead Sea. It was in what is present-day Israel. But so nobody really thought about the Arabian Peninsula. And as a result, and this kind of plays into why these four men had such an outsized influence and were able to sort of operate on their own. Basically, Arabia was a sandbox to the Western imperial powers, because again, they really did not they had geopolitical concerns about carving up the region into their imperial spheres after the war, but the idea of oil was a little bit into the future.
And Aaron Aronson, tell us about him.
Aaron Aronson was an agronomist. He was an agricultural scientist who had emigrated from Romania as a kid to Palestine. He was a Romanian Jew, and was probably the most famous, or certainly the most accomplished agronomist in Syria, and was very loyal to the Ottoman cause. When World War One started, when the Ottomans joined with Germany, he was able to travel around as a scientist through Syria, and he saw the devastation that was coming to the country, in addition to seeing the Armenians being uprooted and dying en masse. And he decided that the only future for the Jewish population in Palestine was to jump to the other side, specifically the British, who were operating out of Egypt. So he set up a Jewish spy ring throughout Palestine, and through a very tortured process, finally put them in service of the British army in Egypt.
And the German spy, Kurt Prüfer.
Yeah, Kurt Prüfer. It's funny. Prüfer had a very similar biography in some ways to Lawrence. He was an Oriental scholar. He had before the war he had been attached to the German embassy in Cairo, but very much a scholar, very slight, a soft-spoken man. And when the war came along, what Germany realized, or their strategy in the Middle East was, we're the only imperial power in Europe that doesn't have Muslim colonies. We don't have Muslims that are our subjects. And so both Prüfer and his immediate supervisor came up with this idea that they could spread Islamic jihad against the European colonial powers, specifically the British and the French, and undermine British and French control in the Middle East basically through insurrection. So Prufer spent almost all of World War One as the chief German counterintelligence officer operating in Syria, and knew Aronson, crossed paths with William Yale. So it's this great kind of spy versus spy story of how these men's lives kept intersecting.
So if Prufer represents Germany's desire, I guess on some level to sort of undercut the British and perhaps the French hegemony, or to the extent that they had any, or attempts to get hegemony in that region, what does Lawrence represent in terms of why those powers wanted that type of influence? I mean, this is, you know, sort of the, if there isn't a sense that there's a huge amount of oil there, enough to justify, you know, sending, you know, Yale and sort of allowing him to freelance, but what was the agenda there?
Well, it's a rather ironic one, because what happened as the war in Europe grew worse and worse, and the body count grew higher and higher. And this was especially true with the French. It was, how do you justify this incredible waste of lives and of treasure? So as the war went on, they looked more and more of what around the world they could grab afterwards as kind of the booties of war, as the consolation for basically having destroyed a generation of your own people. And the area of the world was the Middle East. That was the one sort of uncharted territory. If you start carving up the Ottoman Empire, all those lands come up for grabs. And so really what it was this kind of outdated, by that point, this outdated notion of fashioning territorial empire. So the British grabbed Iraq, and Palestine. The French grabbed what is now Lebanon, which was part of Syria, and they grabbed Syria also. So it was this idea of like carving things up. Why Lawrence is so pivotal, and he is the central character to the book, is that he was a British military intelligence officer attached to Cairo. He then ends up being the liaison to the Arab rebels fighting in Arabia. And what Lawrence knows is that the British have made all these promises to the Arabs, basically to give them virtually full independence after the war of virtually the entire Middle East. At the same time that they've cut a secret deal with the French to carve up those same places between their two empires. So as Lawrence is in the field fighting with the Arab rebels, he becomes more and more morally conflicted, because he knows that the men that he is enlisting to fight and die alongside him, supposedly in the cause for Arab independence, are actually going to be betrayed in the end. And so he became incredibly tortured in his book Seven Pillars of Wisdom. He referred to himself as a fraud and as a charlatan because he was carrying this guilty secret. And he ended up telling the Arab rebels exactly about the secret deal between the British and the French, and really going rogue. Lawrence, by the end of the war, was active, even though still a British army officer, was actively working against the designs of the British crown and fighting for Arab independence.
And that agreement was the Sykes-Picot.
That's right.
Agreement. And I want to return to that in a moment, but Lawrence was there. I mean, there's two things that strike me that interesting just about the notion that he was in a position to betray that knowledge to the I guess it was to the Emir Hussein,
right,
who was the leader of the Bedouin tribes at the time. But
that's right. Yeah.
One thing that strikes me is just we can see the mentality of, or the imperialist mentality of the British, the notion that, you know, this guy, that we can tell Lawrence this, or, I mean, that he can be aware of the fact that he's betraying these people and have absolutely, we have no concerns that he would in any way leak this information, is sort of fascinating, and I think indicative of what the mentality you need to be able to sort of baldly lie in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing too with Lawrence, because really he technically committed treason by, you know, in a time of war to divulge to a third party a secret agreement between two other factions, two warring partners. By any definition, that is treason. There were certainly people who suspected, if did not outright know within the British military hierarchy, that Lawrence had been passing this information to the Arabs. But the interesting thing with the British, and I do think they were unique in this, is they really did hold to this old-fashioned notion that their word was their bond. A man's honor had all to do with about sticking to your promises. And so there were actually a lot of people in the British hierarchies who were aware of how this betrayal was going to play out at the end of the war. And even if they didn't have any great sympathy for the Arabs, and certainly Lawrence had a sympathy for the Arabs, there was this collective sense of kind of revulsion at what the British government was doing. So I think in any other warring faction of World War I, French, the Germans, the Americans, Lawrence would have been put up in front of a firing squad. I think that there was something quite unique about this old-fashioned notion of the British that served to actually inoculate Lawrence.
And so, I mean, let's talk about Lawrence, too, in terms of just, what it was about him that sort of propelled him, both in terms of how successful he was as a military leader and also what compelled him in some ways to, I mean, was it simply that notion of honor that he knew that he was lying to these people that he had befriended, or was there something in his background that sort of allowed him to sort of transcend this notion that he was from the civilized world and he was sort of dealing with the natives?
Right. I think much more the latter. Lawrence had studied at Oxford. He was an archaeologist, and he had gone out about 4 or 5 years before the war started, to an archaeological dig in northern Syria. And he developed this a kind of an instant affinity for Arab culture. And maybe today we would call it going native. But he really studied the way the local clan and tribal structure worked in a way that just didn't happen at that time among Westerners in that part of the world. So he developed a really deep understanding of how that society worked. And so 5 years on, when the war has started and he is sent as this liaison officer to join with the rebels in Arabia, he, far more than any other British officer — it was a small handful of British officers who were involved in this project — he intuitively grasped how to wage war, how to recruit a rebel army among the Arabs, and how to wage war. Interestingly, too, his background at Oxford, even as a child, he was fascinated by medieval military history. And he had this encyclopedic knowledge of the 14th, 15th century battles. And in Arabia, the war in Arabia in the early 20th century looked an awful lot like war in Europe in the 14th century, in the same way that it's war at its most primal. It's like who you attack, when you attack them, is dependent on water, on forage for your animals, on these very basic things. So Lawrence understood how to wage war there much better than a typical trained military officer who understood modern warfare concepts, because it was not modern warfare there. So he really became the chief battlefield commander in Arabia, and the more he assumed that role, the more this moral conflict grew in him. Again, he was in battle after battle, seeing men dying all around him, and knowing that the overwhelming odds were it was all going to be for naught at the end.
Right, knowing that they were dying for a cause. They were dying in the name of something that he knew was inevitably not going to happen.
Absolutely, and fought mightily to try to forestall that or to head it off, including going to the Paris Peace Conference as a representative of the Arabs. And he had this odd. He was still a British officer, but he was acting as a liaison for Hussein and his son Faisal at the Paris Peace Conference. And he so persisted in trying to prevent this imperial dividing up of the Middle East between the British and the French, and trying to get people to stand to the promises that had been made by the Arabs, that ultimately the British government just got rid of him, prevented him from continuing on at the Paris Peace Conference, and he was just mustered out. So the betrayal was complete.
And when he goes to Paris to represent the Arabs, I mean, what does that mean? In other words, what were the aspirations of these people? Because he was an aide to Hussein's son, to Faisal,
right.
Hussein, and Hussein was the leader of the Bedouin tribes. Just tell us the players, because Bedouins now seem to be almost sort of, there doesn't seem to be a nationalism within sort of a pan-nationalism for Bedouins. And maybe I'm phrasing that wrong, but my understanding is that, you know, the Bedouins tend to feel associated with the country that they're in, regardless of what country it is. What were the other sort of tribes? I mean, what was the relationship between did everyone perceive of themselves as Bedouins, as Arabs? I mean, how did people self-ID, and what they were trying to liberate themselves from the Ottoman Empire, but where were the fault lines that existed at that time?
Right. Well, it wasn't just Bedouins. With King Hussein in what was called the Hejaz at the time, which is Western Saudi Arabia today. A lot of the fighters were Bedouins, but it was also local tribes that would not have considered themselves Bedouins. And then as the revolt spread north into Syria and present-day Jordan, they also got a lot of followers from them and from Iraqis. So it really became this kind of pan-Arab movement. So it wasn't just Bedouins. So certainly people from principal cities like Damascus or Aleppo in Syria or Baghdad in Iraq probably had a much stronger sense of Arab nationalism and a desire for Arab independence, more than the what we would call the primitive Bedouin tribes that coming out of Arabia. So it really did become it was kind of a vast umbrella of people who both wanted to get out from under the Ottoman rule, but also wanted to have nothing to do with the colonial powers when it was over.
And you know, there was a piece, and you know, I want to sort of turn a little bit to sort of the aspect of this, how the modern Middle East was a direct result of the French and the British sort of, you know, slicing and dicing.
Right.
But there was a piece I read today in the Atlantic Wire, arguing by Nick Danforth, arguing that the Middle East problems are not a function of those borders, because all borders are arbitrary on some level, but that it was more a function of the agendas that were at play at that time, where the different, I guess, sects and the different sort of ethnicity or religious sects within the Arab world were sort of militarized and hyped as a way of I guess working towards creating the forces that they want. I mean, in some level, you said that the Germans were looking to increase the notion of jihad as a way of undercutting the French and the British. And it seems that the French and the British and the Russians, I mean, the Germans were all sort of playing on these different sort of divisions within the Arab world and enhancing them in some way to further whatever geopolitical goals they had.
Well, yes, that is true. But it's kind of a two-part answer. I think you cannot separate what happened at the end of the war from what's happening today. Because on one level, it's kind of a philosophical level. I think what grew out of that and out of that period when it was divided up between the imperial powers is is this view that still holds throughout the Arab world, is that they were betrayed by the West. And I think what you've seen for the past century is a culture, the Arab culture, that largely defines itself by what it is opposed to, whether it is anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, anti-Western influence. And that is a direct result. I think you see the philosophical seeds of that planted right at the end of World War One. On a more practical level, what happened at the end of the war? Let's take the example of Iraq. Iraq was a totally artificial creation. And people who knew a little bit about Iraq, Lawrence being one, Gertrude Bell being another, they warned the British what was going to happen if you threw the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shia all together in one country, because just beyond those sectarian lines, you have all these tribal lines and caste lines and clan lines. Number one, they're going to be resistant to any sort of Western, i.e. Christian, control. But what's going to happen, because this is a kind of a pre-nationalistic state, once you get outside of the cities, is that people's first loyalties are to their clan and to their tribe. And we saw that play out in Iraq over the last 10 years. There were people, just about 10 years ago today, who were warning the Bush administration what was going to happen. And it was a replay of the warnings that the British were being told in 1919. And the British had a revolt that killed 1,000 British soldiers and some 10,000 civilians. It broke out all along tribal lines. And that's kind of what's happened in Iraq. So the idea that you can somehow separate this is ancient history and it's not playing out today, I just think is a complete fallacy.
Well, so what would be, let's presume, for a moment, let's presume that the Brits and the French did not have this calculation that, we're going to need something to show for this, It's also sort of just a fascinating question as to whether or not that had currency at that time. I mean, I imagine that was sort of one of the last opportunities for that to have any sort of real currency domestically. Half your family may have the males in your family may have died on the front, but we control we control Egypt
right.
With no sort of obvious benefit to the citizen. In an alternate universe where I don't know how we get to that alternate universe, but presume for a moment that calculation wasn't made, how would it have played out with these different sort of forces in the Arab world? How would it be different today had not those arbitrary lines, or maybe they weren't arbitrary. They were arbitrary to the extent that they were negotiated and maybe different parties felt, the imperialist powers felt they had different benefits. But had those artificial borders not been imposed, what would be different today? Or what would the history have been up to this point?
Right. My theory would be, not the golden era that certainly some Arabs, historians seem to believe would have happened. I think things would have been messy anyway, because what you had was this vast empire, the Ottoman Empire, falling apart, and these different groups of people suddenly being free. And Lawrence never had any illusions that somehow this vast area of the Arab world was going to somehow unite in this cohesive one nation. But I think what would have, ideally what would have happened, and certainly this was Lawrence's conception of what was going to happen going forward, was that the different groups of people, and tribal affiliations on a larger level, I mean, there's layer upon layer of kind of tribal affiliation. And the idea is that as the world was, economically progressing, and that these tribal units would join together out of mutual benefit, mutual need, economic need, and that gradually what you would have is a knitting together of out of, and again, out of, not out of coercion, but out of a mutual benefit. The other element that was thrown into this, of course, was the Balfour Declaration, which was this idea of encouraging Jewish emigration into Palestine. And Mark Sykes, who was the British diplomat, who was the co-author of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, Balfour was a whole separate new thing. And he just very blithely said, you know, I see no reason why the resident population of Arabs in Palestine would have any objection to more Jews moving in. So it was decision upon decision like that that happened at the time that no one really gave much thought to, that just continue to echo down today. And of course, I think has led to what I feel is a political stunting in the whole region. It kind of goes back to this idea I mentioned of that this is, it tends to be a part of the world that constantly defines itself by what it's against, rather than what it's for. And you know, we have seen for decades how different repressive military regimes in the region, for example, have used Israel as a whipping boy to channel popular discontent to an external enemy. And I mean, Bashar Assad was doing this just last year when he was, you know, busing Palestinian refugees to the Golan Heights to get them shot at, and as a way to sort of deflect away from the popular discontent with his rule. So I think all these things have kind of come together just to create a morass. And I think what we're at today, kind of veering away a little bit from your question of how it all would have turned out, but I think what we're seeing now, and I'm really quite confident of it at this point, what we're seeing now is a final sort of disintegration of those artificial lines that were imposed 100 years ago. And you've already seen it in Iraq. Iraq today, I mean, no American government official will admit it, but it's essentially three countries now. So is Libya. Libya has fallen back into the three enclaves that existed under the Ottoman times. And that process of disintegration, I think, is just going to continue to spread. I think you're likely to see a further disintegration in Syria. Ironically, the one country that was a completely artificial creation, which is Jordan, at least for the moment, is the most stable. But that could end at any moment, too.
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I think this notion of the Arab world defining itself as what it's not is, I guess just to sort of restate what you're saying to make sure that I'm clear, is just this notion that it in some ways retarded a natural evolution of people coming together and working based upon shared interests that were positive interests, as opposed to a shared interest that being a defensive one. And
that's
so
right.
If I understand you correctly, then we're going to have to go through a period of disintegration. And the more that the West can take itself out of that equation, particularly when it rebuilds, the better.
Right. Right. If you look at the American involvement, it goes all the way back to the Paris Peace Conference in that region. And they basically, after Woodrow Wilson gave a lot of, you know, highfalutin talk about the rights of self-determination and independence and everything, he basically acquiesced to what the British and French wanted. America has always been cast into this, and then of course the United States inherited the whole chessboard as we became a superpower, some would say an imperial power. So we're kind of constantly cast into this reactive role in the region, and constantly, just like the British and French, engaging in, to my mind, just gross wishful thinking based on ignorance. Just to go back to Iraq for a second, I mean, remember how we were all told, you know, that we are, you know, Iraq is going to be a Western Tudor democracy, and it's going to be act as a beacon for the rest of the region. And then a few years later, they send Condoleezza, you know, the Bush administration says, oh, democracy in the region, that's what's going to turn everything around the Middle East. So they send Condoleezza Rice to Cairo to preach about, you know, the spread of democracy. And that idea gets tossed aside when they finally realize, well, you know, you talk about democracy in this part of the world. It's not the Western technocrats who hang out at in Boston or at the embassy cocktail parties. It's the Muslim Brotherhood, it's Hamas, it's Hezbollah. So I just think we have been and continue to be just utterly sort of at sea of how to respond, and even more so how to channel any initiatives in the area.
If I follow what you're saying, the idea that in the context of elections, the winners are Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood, this is a direct function to that definition of themselves as not the West.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I think we've been very, very slow to understand that.
We should also say that the equation's a little bit different now too, because there are interests that the interests have been have changed a little bit in terms of the fact that there's our oil is underneath their sand.
That's right. And I think if you look at Syria right now, you know, people talk about, oh, you know, we should have done something a year ago, you know, when the progressives would have had a chance to take over before everything got radicalized. Well, I mean, is that really true? I mean, I feel we heard the same thing about Libya. It's like, because you see the same talking heads on CNN or who are talking at Harvard. And it's like, we have to empower this moderate opposition. Iraq, it started with Iraq too. And, you know, in all these places, we're going to become these little U.S.-friendly democracies out there. I think at least the Obama administration is being somewhat honest. They frankly have no clue of what's coming in Syria. I mean, is there a Western-style democracy that could possibly take root there? Seems doubtful. I mean, we just don't know. So we're just kind of constantly cast into this reactive role of responding to events that we can very little control, because we are seen as, I mean, you know, if we go through with airstrikes or any sort of military intervention in Syria, and not that I'm actually personally opposed to it necessarily, but you can see that, you know, on one level, this is exactly what Bashar would love to have, because mm-hmm. then he can tar his opposition as American lackeys. This is the Middle Eastern game.
Indeed. Well, Scott Anderson, the book is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to the book on our majority.fm. Like I say, it's getting great reviews, short of the Wall Street Journal, which I think is probably helps as much as the good reviews, at least in these quarters. So appreciate your coming on today.
Oh, my pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program, wherein we will turn on the air conditioning as it is in the mid-90s, I think, in New York City today. When we head in there, we will talk about the latest from President Obama regarding Syria and more. Also, an update on the app. We still have not been approved by Apple because we attempted to take donations in-app, whereas apparently we've got to do it within the browser. So as soon as that happens, we will let you know. We will let you know when it's available to download. It is a fantastic app. You will enjoy it, and you will still be able to make a one-off donation. You'll just have to leave the app, but we will make it as seamless as possible within the constraints that Apple imposes upon us. What are you going to do, folks? What are you going to do? Unless you're Bush and Chains, then you really don't have any other options. All right, we're going to take a break. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. Tomorrow on the program, Matt Apuzzo on his new book, which details the New York Police Department's, I guess, intelligence apparatus. All right, we'll be back in just a moment.